You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Three people remain missing in central Texas after deadly flash flooding swept through the region earlier this month. At least 138 people lost their lives when torrential rain caused a 22-foot rise along the Guadalupe River.
Emergency teams from all over the country have been a part of the recovery effort. Wisconsin's Urban Search and Rescue Task Force is one of those groups.
Members of that task force were deployed to Texas just days after the July 4th flooding. On Monday evening, they returned home safely.
During the team's last days in Texas, we caught up with task force leader Bob Zimmerman, who reflected on nearly 3 weeks of rescue and recovery operations.
We've met some amazing people down here that have been tremendously impacted with loss of life in their family or loss of property. And the focus for our team, like all of the other teams down here, is what can we do to assist in completely searching the river to hopefully bring some closure to the families who have lost loved ones down here.
The task force brought detection dogs into places where flood victims are still missing with the hope that those dogs could point out areas of debris that needed to be cleared and searched.
Zimmerman told us the nature of the job, along with the Texas heat, was a challenge for the group, but he says that working with people from all around Wisconsin and helping in a time of need kept his team going.
We have firefighters here from Superior, Beaver Dam, Anago, Appleton, Green Bay, Sheboygan, Nina Menasha, and Racine. Just that common mission that brings us together and functioning as a unit, that brings us a high level of satisfaction, just being able to do what we're trained to do. I would say that, you know, it's definitely uplifting when you meet the Texans down here. They're just so welcoming and they're so grateful for everybody coming down. It's kind of humbling, actually. They're thanking us for coming down, and we just want to be here to be able to help them out. So they're just really neat folks. We've had just a good experience in working with all of them and all the other agencies, you know, these federal and state USAR teams from around the country, being able to connect with them, compare notes, share the commonality again of the mission, and just spending time in theater with them, working together for that common goal has been something that has been very uplifting to the members of the team.
Zimmerman said that putting the team's training to use in a real-world scenario will help them be prepared if a similar catastrophe would happen here in Wisconsin.
The operational experience that we get in operating in this type of an environment, in addition to working with several other USAR teams from around the country, is invaluable. It's a skill set that we can hone while we're down here, while helping the people in Texas. And it's one that we will bring back with us into Wisconsin so that we are that much more prepared to respond when needed in the state of Wisconsin.
That's Bob Zimmerman, leader of Wisconsin's Urban Search and Rescue Task Force. The group returned home earlier this week from Central Texas, where members have been helping respond to this month's deadly flooding.
Now to efforts assisting veterans who are at risk of homelessness. Wisconsin has three shelters that serve veterans in Bellevue near Green Bay, Union Grove, and Chippewa Falls. Two of those shelters are slated to shut down because funding intended to keep them open was not included in the new two-year state budget.
A group of Green Bay area lawmakers are circulating a bill that seeks to restore funding so that the Bellevue and Chippewa Falls locations could stay open.
Jamie Wall is a Democratic state senator representing a district that includes the metropolitan Green Bay region. State Senator Wall, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Lay out what you are requesting in your bill.
Well, it's pretty straightforward. The state has a program called the Veterans Housing and Recovery Program, and what it does is it works with veterans who are homeless or who are in danger of becoming homeless, and it gives them a safe place to live and helps them get back on their feet, you know, with things like job counseling, hooking them up with other resources that they need. I've got a lot of respect for veterans. My dad was a combat veteran in the Korean War, and these are folks who've served their country and done more for the rest of us than most of us do. All right, so they're always a high priority for me. And as you said, from my perspective, this was a miss in the state budget. This is something that we should have handled. We had a motion on the floor when we were considering the final budget bill to fix this, but that was voted down on not quite a party line vote. There was one Republican who crossed over to vote with us. But we're just trying to fix the mistake that was made and to allocate some money to keep these facilities open in the Green Bay area and then across the state in Chippewa Falls as well.
How has the shelter in Bellevue, what has it meant to the constituents and the communities you serve?
Well, like I said, veterans are very close to the top of my list of people that we should be looking after in state government. This is transitional housing for them. This is not a permanent solution, but what we're doing is we're helping folks who've helped us get their lives straight, and that's important. I mean, some of the people who live there's 16 veterans in that facility right now, and some of them are from the Green Bay area, some of them are a little further afield, but no matter where they're from, I think we should, we should help support them and give them the help they need and help them become, get back to being productive members of society again, given what they've, the service that they've given to our country.
And so this bill would restore this $1.9 million to provide the supplies, the service costs to keep the Bellevue and Chippewa Falls facilities open?
That's exactly right. It's actually a contract with Lutheran Social Services. So they operate the facilities and they provide these sort of wraparound services for the veterans there. So it's things like job counseling, identifying education programs that might be useful, maybe some substance abuse treatment, depending on the needs of the people who live there. So this is all kind of work that Lutheran Social Services or any other kind of social service organization would do, but specifically targeted at veterans in need.
So you're circulating the bill. Where does it stand currently? And are you getting some bipartisan support on it?
Yes. What happens is you circulate these bills for about a week and give people a chance to think about them and whether they want to sign on. So we actually introduced it, maybe a week or 10 days ago now. And we do have bipartisan support. We have almost every Democrat in the state Senate on it, and that's the area I know best. But we have a few Republicans, one from the Chippewa Falls area, and then a couple Republican Assembly folks as well. And I've talked to some of them. Republicans have the majority in both houses of the legislature, so I mean they have more to do than I as to whether the bill moves or not. But I do know there's bipartisan support for this. Veterans are not a controversial cause, okay? And $1.9 million, that's a lot of money for you and me, but in the context of the state budget, I think it's well worth it for this population. So I'm hopeful that when we get back in September, we'll be able to act on this quickly. But that decision is not so much in my hands and more in the Republican leadership of both the Assembly and the Senate.
State Senator, while you said that, as you mentioned, there's not another floor period until the beginning of September when the legislature is together in session and actively debating and voting on legislation. Can these shelters hold on with their current funding and their services until then?
It's going to be sticky. We've had those conversations with the Department of Veterans Affairs. They've already started transitioning some of these folks to the Union Grove facility, which is slated to remain open. I guess of the three, the physical facility was in the best shape, and that's why they made that choice. So there are 16 residents now in Bellevue, and I guess six of them have already agreed to be relocated, and the department is working with the others. But if we act quickly, I don't know what our odds would be of calling the legislature back into a special session, probably very low, but I guess in theory, that's another possible avenue. But if we act quickly, when we come back, we can still pull the fat out of the fire here. But the timing isn't ideal. You're absolutely correct.
And if the bill would not pass, two of Wisconsin's three, of the three veterans' homeless shelters would have to shut down. What might happen to people who rely on these safety net services if the services are no longer there?
Well, I mean, there's just going to be fewer seats at the table, less room at the inn, right? And we've been speaking to the Department of Veterans Affairs, and they're going to do their best to make sure that they take care of the people who are currently at the two facilities slated for closure. But ultimately, there's just going to be fewer seats at the table, and somebody's going to be left without a meal, So I think that's a shame. I mean, again, I mean, aside from maybe children with disabilities, I can't think of a more deserving population than veterans who are struggling with homelessness, right? So this was just a failure on the part of the legislature and a miss in the budget process. But part of the issue, I think, back in the budget was that, as you remember, there were a lot of negotiations between the governor and legislative leaders, but they were constrained to only a few issues, to taxes, to childcare, to schools, to the UW. And everything else, the Republicans in the Finance Committee sort of pencil whipped. We almost the rest of the entire state budget is sort of cost to continue, status quo. They really didn't take a hard look at any of that, and this was just a miss. And that was because they ran a bad process. But this was a particularly bad example of, real deserving people getting hurt because of that bad process. So we're trying to remedy that with this bill.
How are you feeling overall about the new state budget?
It's not the budget I would have written, but we were at the table and we were able to improve it. We were able to do some good things for childcare, and I tell you, the state childcare industry is facing a crisis right now, and that's a problem for not just families with kids, but also their employers. I supported the budget ultimately. It was a good budget for the University of Wisconsin. We improved the situation that our K-12 schools have, but we didn't do enough. But the alternative wasn't more money for schools. It was much, much less.
Well,
So, look, I was just faced with a situation. I chose to make the best deal that we could, and that's what we did. It wasn't perfect, and maybe it wasn't even good, but it was a heck of a lot better than the alternatives.
State Senator Wall, thank you for joining us.
I appreciate it.
Jamie Wall, Democratic State Senator representing Wisconsin's 30th Senate District, includes Green Bay. He talked about his bill that would fund two homeless shelters for veterans in Bellevue and Chippewa Falls.
Coming up, how to pay for med school. The CEO of the Medical College of Wisconsin responds to changes to the federal student loan system.
We may be shifting more toward a demographic of people that already have significant means and significant wealth that are able to afford to go to medical school.
That conversation is next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. New changes to student loans can make it more costly for people from lower or middle-income backgrounds to afford medical school.
President Trump's tax and spending bill signed into law this month includes a sweeping series of changes to the federal student loan system. Among them are eliminating Grad PLUS loans and imposing strict new caps on federal student loans.
The law will restrict borrowing for professional schools to $50,000 per year. Previously, students in medical school could use Grad PLUS loans to borrow up to the full cost of their program. About half of all medical students have taken out these Grad PLUS loans in recent years.
To look at the potential impact of these caps and financing medical school, we turn to Dr. John Raymond, President and CEO of the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Raymond, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much, Kate.
One provision of the new tax cut and spending law eliminates the Grad PLUS loans, and it puts a cap on how much students can take out for professional loan programs like med school. And that cap is at $200,000 total. What importance do these types of loans have in helping students afford the cost of medical school?
Thank you so much. These loans are essential for many of our students. About 80% of our students receive some sort of financial aid, and most of those involve government-sponsored and government-subsidized loans. It's expensive to go to medical school, and without those loans, people that don't have significant means would struggle to be able to pay the tuition. So putting a cap of $200,000 is somewhat problematical because the average lifetime debt burden for education of a student that graduates from a private medical school is about $250,000. And that's the average debt. And factor in that maybe 20% of the students have no debt. You can see that that $200,000 cap would require the students then to go to the private market to make up the difference in the federally supported loans. The Grad PLUS loan itself is actually the backbone of the loans that many of our professional and graduate students take out to really help them be able to afford their education. And the reason why these are desirable loans is that they do not require a co-signature, and they have favorable terms, including repayment terms. This cap of $150,000 clearly is less than the total cost of going to medical school, and this will require students to take out private loans, under which there may be unfavorable terms. They may require a co-signature from someone else, and those will become barriers for students that perhaps come from underserved areas. They may be on the low end of the socioeconomic scale, or they're first generation college students for their family. So this is going to be a significant challenge for many of those students.
Dr. Raymond, the cost of tuition alone at Medical College of Wisconsin is more than $65,000 a year. With these borrowing caps that you see, are you concerned about students being able to afford to become a doctor in Wisconsin?
I am concerned. So first of all, we'll fill our class with people that are willing to take out the loans. But what I'm most concerned about is that we will lose a segment of our population in terms of their willingness or ability to go to medical school. And again, people that come from families that don't have significant financial resources, that perhaps can't get a cosigner for private student loans, or our first generation college students. We may be shifting more toward a demographic of people that already have significant means and significant wealth that are able to afford to go to medical school.
If physicians in training continue to pursue higher paying subspecialties and they see these caps as well, what might be the effect on lower paying practices like family medicine and pediatrics? And since primary care, there's a shortage now of physicians.
Yeah, that's such an important question, Kate. And I think you're really onto something there. If students have significant lifetime debt, they're more likely to choose specialties that are more highly remunerative. And I'm also concerned that we're going to lose students who have an interest in pursuing research careers or even joining our faculty. They will be pursuing specialties that provide higher compensation. And this is totally understandable. You know, to take out significant student debt to become a physician requires a lot of delayed gratification and sacrifices by their families. If you think about it, you go to medical school for 4 years, you rack up this $250,000 debt, and then you go into a residency training program for 3 to 5 years where you're really not making a lot of money. Typically, these students would be coming out in their mid-30s with a lot of debt, with family obligations. And so it would be natural for them to pursue the fields that will pay them higher salaries more quickly.
We've been focusing here on physicians, but do these new caps affect students' ability to pursue jobs in other medical fields, like, say, becoming a certified anesthesiology assistant, or you mentioned, you know, academic pursuits, you know, MD, PhDs, perhaps?
Yes, exactly. The Grad PLUS loans are really there for professional and graduate student education. So for the fields that require a long period of time, doctoral fields or some of the healthcare professions that are not physician professions, this could put a real crimp on the types of people that are willing, again, to have this delayed gratification.
Republicans in Congress have claimed caps on student loan borrowing are to put, you know, the onus on colleges to rein in the rising cost of tuition. As you look inward at Medical College of Wisconsin, will you make changes? Will you lower the cost of tuition in response to these caps?
Well, obviously, that's a really important question. And let me just start by saying that at MCW, we already subsidize the tuition of our medical students by about 50%. So we collected $71 million of tuition revenue last year, which is a lot. But the total cost of our education program was about $142 million. So why is it so expensive? Well, first of all, we live in a technology-rich environment. Secondly, and that has to be refreshed every 3 years or so. Secondly, the student-teacher ratios really require a highly compensated faculty member to be spending a lot of time with small groups of students. So you can't pack a lecture hall with hundreds of students and get the economy that you might have there in terms of the teaching. It's typically done in small group sessions. So that's very expensive. And in many cases, including the Medical College of Wisconsin, we're taking highly compensated clinical faculty away from the clinic or highly compensated research faculty away from their laboratories. These are the folks that can really teach very well what the clinical correlates are and what the basic science is, but they're expensive. And there's an opportunity cost because then they're not in the clinic or they're not in their lab pursuing discoveries and new grants. So the model intrinsically is actually quite expensive.
We've also seen some schools like NYU and Cleveland Clinic going toward, you know, a full tuition scholarship for med school students, regardless of their ability to pay. Will we see more of this?
I think we will see more of it. And if we have a donor that has $2.5 billion, that would like to give us, we could be able to do that for our students as well. You know, we're the third largest private medical school in the country at 270 students per class, and we have to subsidize the education of each and every one of those. So it really requires two things. One is a donor that has that kind of capacity, and the second is a relatively small class size. Cleveland Clinic has a very small medical school. And the NYU example, they actually had to shrink their medical school class to accommodate the endowment that was created by their donor base. So in some ways, although that lowers the barrier of entry for students because they're not accumulating debt, there also are fewer spots that the medical school is able to provide.
Dr. John Raymond is with us, president and CEO of the Medical College of Wisconsin, as we talk about paying for medical training and a closer look here at the physician shortage that Wisconsin is facing. You know, we're seeing this estimated to be physician shortage to be nearly 2,300 doctors by the end of the decade. Why is Wisconsin facing such a shortage of physicians?
Yeah, thank you. Really important question. So first of all, there is a national shortage, and Wisconsin is not immune to that. The medical field is a national and an international profession. We have, I think, adequate capacity in our medical schools to train the workforce of the future, the physician workforce of the future. The bottleneck isn't at the medical school level. In fact, medical schools have expanded their class sizes and 30 or so schools have been created over the last couple of decades, so that we're actually training enough doctors. Where we run into problems is with the graduate medical education. Once a student graduates medical school, then they go on and do an internship and a residency so that they can specialize in family medicine or surgery, pediatrics, obstetrics, internal medicine, and so on. The government has a cap that has been in place since 1995. With the First Balanced Budget Act on these residency programs. So in order to train a resident above that cap, where you're not getting any more federal funds, health systems and medical schools then have to come up with the money to be able to pay for those, the education of those students. And if you think about it, when they go to residency, they're making a salary between $60,000 and $70,000 a year. You have to have malpractice insurance. You have to have a compliance infrastructure built around them. You have to have a teaching infrastructure. You have to have a patient safety infrastructure. All those things cost money. So the total cost of educating a resident after they graduate from medical school tends to be around $150,000 per year. Without help from the government, that cuts into the margins of a health system or requires a medical school to make more investments in education. And I want to make sure everybody understands there's big money in medicine, but the margins that health systems are having right now has been low. It's been in the 2% range. And the same goes for educational institutions. They're suffering from very low margins. So the ability to continue to add on to these subsidizations is rather limited.
Dr. Raymond, you're in an urban environment, but we've seen two hospitals and nearly 20 clinics closed in the Chippewa Valley region last year. Are efforts at bringing doctors to rural areas affected by these cuts at rural clinics and hospitals?
They are. It's kind of a complicated question, but we were part of the family medicine residency in Eau Claire, and really we didn't have a sponsor after HSHS left that market. So we are feeling that impact directly. And MCW does have two regional campuses in De Pere and Wausau that are really designed to meet those rural healthcare workforce needs. We specifically select students who come from rural areas and say that they want to eventually practice in a rural serving area. So your question is really very important because we not only have a shortage of physicians, we have a significant maldistribution here in Wisconsin. We have plenty of doctors in the Milwaukee area, plenty in Madison. But when you get up into the Northwoods or into central cities, urban areas, there's a significant underrepresentation of both primary care and specialty workforce. So this is going to be a challenge because if you think about what I was saying about the Grad Plus loans, many students coming from rural areas are first-generation students. They may come from farming communities. They may not have a lot of family wealth to lean back on. And so when they're making a decision about whether to start this long journey of being a physician, expensive journey, they may actually choose not to do that.
I want to ask you about cuts in research. You said this spring that the Medical College of Wisconsin lost around $5 million in research grants after cuts to the National Institutes of Health. Is that currently the case? Can you give us an update?
Yeah, thank you. We've had 14 grants canceled. A few of them have been restored, but the impact over 3 years is somewhere between $6 and $8 million. That's something that we can accommodate within our budget. People have grants come and go. What's a bigger threat is the proposal to reduce the National Institutes of Health budget by 40%. That's about an $18 billion cut. The immediate impact on MCW could be as much as $50 to $60 million a year. And if you think about it, grants are given out in 3 to 5 year tranches. If you're cutting a budget by 40%, even if you didn't give any grants for a year, you would still have to do further cuts to the grants that were already awarded. So there are some costs in the research that was started, in some cases clinical trials, and there are some costs in the personnel that you've already hired up that you may have to let go if those grants are reduced. There's a chilling effect on the morale of early career scientists who also have a very long journey full of sacrifice to be able to have an independent research laboratory. And many of these are our best and brightest students. And if they feel demoralized, if they see their faculty having to let people go, or in fact, in the worst case scenario, having the faculty themselves lose jobs, many of them are going to choose not to go into research. And we could lose a whole generation of aspiring young scientists because of this uncertainty.
You've had a long career in medicine, in the medical community. Can you compare this moment to anything else?
Yes, I have been a National Institutes of Health funded scientist for the bulk of my career. I trained with a Nobel laureate. and had a very robust laboratory. I also have been significantly involved in peer review for the National Institutes of Health for decades. The threat right now of a 40% cut is absolutely unprecedented. The National Institutes of Health is not the reason why we may be having problems with annual deficits in the federal budget. It's basically the budget there has grown at or a little bit above the rate of inflation, if you average that out since the 1960s. And to have such a precipitous cut, it truly is unprecedented. And we've gone through some ups and downs over the years, but nothing of this magnitude.
Dr. Raymond, thank you for this conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much. Really appreciate what you're doing, Kate. Thank you.
Dr. John Raymond is the president and CEO of the Medical College of Wisconsin. We've been talking about federal changes to student loans and the impact on medical school students and how it could affect healthcare in our state. For disclosure, the Medical College of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you work in the medical field, if you're a doctor or nurse yourself, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this news. Did you take out a Grad PLUS loan to help pay for your education? How much of a difference did it make? What do you think would be the impact of the government eliminating those loans?
Or did you or someone you know decide against medical school because of the cost? Let us know about your experiences and what you think is needed to graduate enough doctors in Wisconsin.
Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can also leave us a voicemail or a text. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Still ahead, Wisconsin is a hotbed for mustard ahead of National Mustard Day. Discover a slow-cooked recipe from Heartland.
Our mustard is cooked and thickened with eggs, very similar to an old-fashioned custard.
In pursuit of the sweet and tangy and the zing, that's next on WPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a look at the state's dating scene.
Not long ago, dating apps were heralded as a fresh and modern way to meet that special someone. But they come with unique challenges and are now pushing their users to seek alternatives. WPR's Anna Marie Yanni recently attended an artsy singles mixer in Madison and asked people why they were motivated to look for that special someone in person.
If I hadn't been covering this event, I might have attended it. I'm in my late 20s, single, and I've had my share of dating app horror stories.
And it can be really hard, too, when you meet someone that isn't like their profile shows you, right? Because you're very much curating how you want to appear to the world.
That's Tegan Davis sitting with her friend Ellie Braun. They're both in their mid-20s, they're artists, educators, and they're also both single. And a few months ago, they were talking about the movie Ghost, which has this romantic pottery scene.
Oh, my love.
Tegan and I have both talked about with our friends how difficult like meeting people in person is and on like dating apps. So I think there's definitely like a desire for people to have these kinds of events where like you know going into it that if you talk to someone they're going to be single instead of like trying to put yourself out there at a bar where you don't know what someone's situation is.
So the two friends created a singles mixer around an art activity.
Are you here
for a mixer? I am.
Awesome. What's your name?
Spencer.
Spencer, great.
On a recent evening, 16 singles gathered at a Madison cocktail bar to paint pottery. The group includes star Welk Schwartz, a 26-year-old who arrived at the event rocking red hair and winged eyeliner.
I feel like something like this, you know, you see people as people. You don't see them as something like on your screen.
She says dating apps can feel almost inhumane. There's a lack of empathy. That's not the case here.
There's like more of an intention here. It's like you're actually trying to meet people.
At the event, she paints her cats on a mug while chatting at a table with four others. Across the room, 24-year-old Ben Goss is adding a cow to his mug. He says he came to the event to get experience dating.
I haven't really gone on many dates. I've gone on a date with a friend. That's it, basically.
Goss says he's ultimately looking for a relationship, but he doesn't trust the apps will get him there.
They're able to, through algorithms, choose who you see and who sees you.
He says instead he'd like to go to more events like this one.
If everybody gets out there, then everybody's out there. Then we don't have the dating apps no more.
Dating apps do work for some people. According to a 2023 study, 1 in 10 adults met their partners online. But others, like many of the people here, are tired of the apps. A Singles Report survey of hundreds of 18 to 54-year-olds found about 80% of them felt burnout or fatigue while online dating. A few people told me they sought out this event because they were looking for something they couldn't quite replicate on the apps, an in-person connection.
For me, it's facial expression, tone of voice, body language.
That's 42-year-old Aaron Rosted.
You get those subtle nonverbal cues in person that you cannot get through a text message.
Rosted says he's trying to limit his swipes on the apps. Going out in the community is more of his style. Plus, he says the pottery activity makes for a good conversation starter.
Having something to do with your hands or like talk about what you're doing as opposed to just being like, hey, do you come here often?
By the end of the event, I didn't see any for sure matches. But maybe people just need more time for sparks to fly. And they may have the chance at future mixers the organizers are planning. Maybe I'll attend one without a microphone next time.
WPR's Anna Marie Yanni brought us that story on in-person dating. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Middleton is set to paint the town yellow for National Mustard Day on Saturday.
The annual street festival celebrates this king of condiments with mustard-themed activities and food, including a mustard ice cream.
Over the years, Wisconsin has become a haven for mustard. We're home to the National Mustard Museum, the worldwide mustard competition, and prize-winning mustard makers all around the state.
They show off unique flavors like root beer mustard from Sprecher and cherry mustard from Door County. Later, we'll hear from an award-winning mustard creator and Zing Master from Silver Spring Foods in Eau Claire.
But first, Jerry Meshing is the founder of East Shore Specialty Foods in Heartland and the creator of its signature sweet and tangy mustard. She spoke with WPR's Lee Rayburn last week.
Let's start with the origin story of East Shore Specialty Foods and how you came to make your own mustard. How long ago was it and how did it come about?
I actually started the company in 1986. I had children who were quite grown up and was looking kind of for something to do and made things for an annual Christmas boutique in Cedarburg, Wisconsin. People liked the mustard so much, I decided that it was worth looking at making it year-round and actually selling it. So that's how it started.
Where did you get your signature mustard recipe, sweet and tangy?
I have made it for, to me, it seems like forever. And long, long ago, the recipe was actually on the mustard tin from Coleman's Mustard.
Wow. So what makes your mustard different?
Our mustard is cooked and thickened with eggs, very similar to an old-fashioned custard. That makes it very different because most mustards consist of vinegar and ground mustard seeds, along with a lot of salt. Ours contains no salt and is cooked.
So what? How does that make your mustard different then in the end? When it comes to taste and texture, what does this slow cooking process mean for this mustard?
The taste is very intense. And the texture is very smooth and tends to be, I think, thicker than other mustards. So it spreads very nicely.
Yeah, and this has now become a family business since 1986, right?
Yes, it has.
Tell us a little bit about how your family's now involved with East Shore Specialty.
My daughter, Kristen, has been here for a very long time. She actually is the president of the company now. I also have a grandson. Kristen's son, Alex, is heading up our production team.
So what is Jerry Meshing doing these days?
Just a lot of watching.
How about tasting?
Relaxing. Oh, I still taste everything. Everything they make practically every day.
So how do you come up with some of these new varieties of mustard? What's the testing process like, Jerry?
The testing process was, if I had an idea, I would stir it up and see if people liked it. And we have never discontinued any of the mustards that we have in our line. Every one that we started is still part of our line of mustards.
Like cherry and cranberry mustards. And
yes.
Also I see key lime with ginger. What would I put key lime with ginger mustard on, Jerry?
Oh, perhaps a turkey sandwich. Or anything with cheese. It goes very well with cheese. I also do a lot of cooking with all of the mustards. The key lime makes a wonderful salad vinaigrette.
What is it you love about mustard?
It's so versatile, and I as mentioned, I do a lot more cooking with it than putting it on a sandwich. We call it the perfect secret ingredient. If you're making something as simple as deviled eggs,
yes,
using our East Shore Sweet and Tangy just is the perfect secret ingredient.
Jerry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so very much.
We're talking about specialty mustards in Wisconsin ahead of National Mustard Day coming up August 2nd. And that was Jerry Meshing, founder of East Shore Specialty Foods in Heartland and the original creator of their signature sweet and tangy mustard. Now we head over to Eau Claire, where local mustard makers have recently brought home two international awards. Samantha Bibbs is a food technologist at Silver Spring Foods, the world's largest grower and producer of horseradish. And Sam, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
So what goes into making a mustard at Silver Spring?
Yeah, so a mustard starts out as a brine, so it's water and vinegar and mustard seeds and a variety of other ingredients, and those get mixed together, and then they go through our mustard mills. Sometimes they go through rough mills and fine mills to get that fineness and that smoothness how we want it. And that's for like our base mustard, so we'll make a yellow mustard that way, and then sometimes we'll take that yellow mustard and pump it into a different tank where we put relish if it's going to be dill pickle mustard, or we'll add jalapenos for our jalapeno mustard. And that's kind of how we get our different varieties. So we can just have a milled mustard, or we can pump that milled mustard into a tank and really switch it up and make a new variety.
So give us the difference, if you would, between yellow and brown mustards. What gives them all the different flavor profiles?
Yeah, so it's all in the mustard seeds. So there's yellow mustard seeds, brown mustard seeds, and oriental seeds. And they each have a different flavor profile. The yellow is a lot more milder than the brown or the oriental. The brown has a lot of that nasal pungency, that spice. It's actually the same compound that's found in horseradish. So that's why we do mustard and are so good at mustard, especially a spicy mustard like our beer and brat. And then oriental seeds kind of have a bitterness to them that can kind of round out that flavor, that tang that you get with a mustard.
So do you have a favorite mustard right now in particular?
I love the dill pickle mustard. I'm a big fan of just a classic yellow mustard. And then with the dill and like the pickle, it's just kind of fun and trendy and summery. So I really like that one.
So Silver Spring brought home a couple of awards at this year's Worldwide Mustard Competition, and I understand Dill Pickle was one of them.
It was. Dill Pickle got a silver medal in the herb and spice category this year.
And what was your other winner?
Our beer and brat. That one was in, I believe, the horseradish mustard category, and that also won a silver. It has won gold in the past, but it took home silver this year.
It's still award-winning. So tell us a little bit about the Zing Masters at Silver Spring. This sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is fun. It's our in-house sensory panel. I get to run the panel, which is super fun. I really loved my sensory coursework when I was getting my food science degree. And it's a panel of about 40 people who all work at Silver Spring. And they go through a training where we go over the basic tastes and different sensory tests that they can expect to go through every time we meet. And once a month, usually we get together and I present them something. We will either be determining how hot something is, how hot we're perceiving it to be, so that we can assign that zing factor to it, which you'll see on our refrigerated line. Other times we meet and discuss different sauces that we might want to release, and if we like them, if we don't like them, what we would change. It's just a really nice panel to have in-house and be able to have access to that resource.
Sam, I'm curious if there are flavors that have ended up on the cutting room floor. Are there some things you tried that just didn't pass the Zing Master test?
Definitely. I definitely sometimes just get a wild hair and make some crazy mustards. I think the craziest one I made was apple cider mustard, which was wild, but it was surprisingly delicious. It was kind of like honey mustard, but apple-y.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
I kind of want to be a Zing Master now, Sam.
It's pretty fun.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. What do you think makes Silver Spring mustard so special? What is it about this process? What is it about the products that brings these international awards to your backyard?
Yeah, I think a lot of what makes our mustard so special and so good is just like the pride that goes into making our mustard. It's really quite the intensive process. There's a bunch of different mills that all have to be dialed in to the exact fineness to produce that consistent product. And the people who mill the mustard take a lot of pride in that. And they're running around making sure everything is exactly how it should be. And it definitely pays off in our product.
Sure. And then what is it about Wisconsin that makes it such a mustard hub, do you think?
I think that Wisconsin is a good mustard hub, probably because of the German heritage in Wisconsin. But I also think that Wisconsin really enjoys things that mustard pairs well with. Like, we enjoy grilling brats by the lake and going to a potluck with potato salad and that comfort food where you would use mustard. We kind of love to do that. So I think they kind of just go together.
I want to thank you so much for sharing your work with us today. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks for having me.
That is Samantha Bibbs, food technologist and Zing Master at Silver Spring Foods in Eau Claire. Earlier, we heard from Jerry Meshing, founder of East Shore Specialty Foods in Heartland. They spoke with Lee Rayburn about the tradition of mustard making in Wisconsin and what goes into making unique and award-winning mustards.
National Mustard Day is Saturday, and Middleton, home of the National Mustard Museum, is set to host a mustard-themed street festival in honor of that day. Author, educator, and Vietnam veteran in Madison, Doug Bradley has a new music-based memoir called Tracks of My Years. He makes the point that music is where memory lives and that we all have a soundtrack to our lives.
Are there particular songs that call up certain memories for you? Maybe it was a song from high school you played over and over again, or a song that you share with a person you love. Rob, you're a musician. Is there a song that transports you back to a specific time and place?
Do we have 3 hours, Kate? There are so many. I've been going back, listening to stuff from the 90s, Lush, Ryan Maria, Lungfish, so many more that take me back to, you know, the sort of garbagey apartments I lived in back in those days.
Share your songs and your stories. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can also call or text us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Colleen Leahy, Trevor Hook, and Rochelle Wilson. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Lee Rayburn. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Vera.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.